This is Fresh Air. When you think of the University of California at Berkeley in the 60s, you probably think of the free speech movement. Larry Colton was on the opposite end of campus culture. He belonged to the jock fraternity Pi Kappa Alpha. These brothers defined what Colton thought of as masculinity. They were good athletes, they were good looking, they chased women, and could hold their beer. In the late 80s, Colton started wondering if his former frat brothers were having the same troubles he was, adapting to the social changes the decades had brought. He wondered if they were also divorced, if they were still Casanovas, if they still wore madras. So he tracked down four of his fraternity brothers and wrote a book about how their lives and his own had changed. His book is called Goat Brothers. Colton was surprised by many of the things he learned about his old friends.
I think what surprised me the most was how little I knew them back then. So getting to know them now, the change was it was large. But what struck me is the secrets that we kept back then.
Let's hear a couple of those secrets. Why don't we start with one of the really big secrets, and that was the secret of Ron Vaughn.
Ron Vaughn was perhaps the most interesting, and for me personally, in the four other people that I profiled in the book, Ron Vaughn, the book takes place in starts in 1960 in the fraternity in Berkeley, and we had strict white clause in there prohibiting blacks from being in the fraternity, and Ron Vaughn was a light-skinned black, and he lived in the fraternity, and the other members of the fraternity didn't know that he was black. And so he kept that secret, and he also had a secret. He had fathered a child of which he had abandoned in those years. And so those two secrets that he kept weighed heavily and caused him, you know, to have guilt feelings later on.
When you say abandoned it, he took the newborn infant to the hospital and said somebody had, you know, that he just found it abandoned on the street.
That's correct. And the baby was only 24 hours old when he found it. And when it was, his girlfriend called him over and he took off with it. And of course, that has haunted him ever since. And he's never reconnected with that child, doesn't know where it is.
Another secret by another former frat brother, Steve Radich.
Steve Radich was a big man on campus, very handsome man, and he had gotten his girlfriend, his high school girlfriend, pregnant, and they ended up getting married. His father demanded that they get married. They got married. She had the child. She stayed in Sacramento. He lived in Berkeley, but unbeknownst to everybody else in the fraternity, we didn't know that he was married with child, and he continued to date and be a big man on campus with this secret marriage back home.
Did you have a big secret yourself?
The magnitude of these other guys, certainly. In going back over these lives, I felt like I had led a pretty simple life in college. I mean, I wasn't... I was pretty behind the times when it came to women, and so I guess my secret was that I was not successful in that area.
Your big secret was you were a virgin until age 21.
Right. I was afraid to say that, but yeah, that's exactly what my secret was. And guys didn't, you know, I didn't go into my group of 20-year-old guys and say, "Hey, guess what, fellas? I'm a virgin." That wasn't cool in those days.
Do you think that there was something about the time or about the types of people that you were trying to be that required keeping secrets?
Oh, definitely. It was just the way it was in those days. I mean, men, we had grown up believing that we were supposed to be this embodiment of masculinity and a fraternity, and we were all athletes, collegiate athletes. And so we bought into this myth that you were supposed to be womenizers, you were supposed to be strong and non-emotional, almost. And so we went there with that perception, and we lived that out, which then, of course, later on came back to haunt us.
There was a night, I believe it was back when you were pledging, when a lot of the fraternity brothers are upstairs engaging in a gang banging. How's that? Is that okay way to put it?
Well, that's a very painful way for me to think of it now. I mean, at the time, I pretty much shut my mind to it. And this type of stuff, unfortunately, I've read a lot of stories recently where it continues on college campuses across the nation. And it's despicable behavior. And
that's why I'm interested in finding out what it was like to be on the periphery of that, to be, you know, not participating, but to have your brothers and your fraternity participating. What did you make of it? Did you talk about that stuff?
No, we didn't talk about it. If we did, we just kind of chuckled about it. And in retrospect, obviously, it was a rape. And obviously, when I went back to write that, it caused tremendous inner turmoil, you know, thinking about that, because I had blocked that out for 20-some-odd years, thinking about it. And when, at the time, I didn't think about it. We used the term gangbang back there. And so it was, I just shut it off and thought about something else. And I knew it was going on. I did nothing to stop it. And I feel guilty for that now. At the time, I think I just shut it off. And I didn't, the concept of either date rape or any of that was not, we weren't cognizant of back then.
My guest is Larry Colton. Time for a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Larry Colton. His new book, Goat Brothers, is about how his life and the lives of four of his fraternity brothers changed since the 1960s. Larry, a lot of the first part of your life revolved in many ways around sex. I mean, your secret, so to speak, and the fraternity was that you were a virgin until you were 21. But then after that, one of the great disappointments, I think, in your marriages was that good sex didn't last very long when you were on the road once you were a professional ball player. You had relationships with a lot of women who you'd kind of pick up, give them a kind of fake phone number, not mention that you were married, that kind of thing. Looking back, like, where do you think that came from?
It might have started in the fraternity, probably started earlier than that. Just was the message that men received back then and still do receive, that you have to be the conqueror, that you have to be the ladies' man out there. And because of the accessible nature of it, when I was on the road as a professional athlete, it was like, well, here I am. Okay, I'll take advantage of this. I mean, I wasn't quite as cavalier as that about it. But when I hear, like yourself, Terry, saying that, I mean, it really, it just sounds a very discordant note to me about, and makes me ashamed that that kind of stuff went on. And why I did it was probably matters of ego and lack of self-esteem. Although you might say, well, he was a professional athlete, why wouldn't he feel good? But I think men, they're, doesn't matter how successful, or, you know, whether they're the top of the CEO or the 20 game winner in the big leagues, they still have these self doubts. And that was one way back in the late 60s, early 70s, with the sexual revolution going on and the easy availability of that, that was to temporarily satisfy that. And I thought at the time that I had a good marriage.
When you made it to the major leagues and you were picked up as a pitcher by the Philadelphia Phillies, what did that mean to you, and what did it mean to your friends? Did everybody think of you as like an incredible success story? I mean, that's really something, to make it into the major leagues.
Well, I guess because that was something that I had been pointing towards since I was 5 years old, or thinking about, it was almost, this was my manifest destiny. I mean, I wasn't able to step back from it and look, say, what an incredible accomplishment that was, because I was so taken with, you know, working on my curveball or who I had to beat out to make the team.
Your career was cut short because of a shoulder injury. How long had you played when you had to retire?
Well, Terry, I've set a record of you and have only played in one less big league baseball game than I have. I'm only one ahead of you, Terry. I've got one game. I played in one game. I pitched against Cincinnati, and first batter I ever faced was Pete Rose, and he smacked a double off me on my third major league pitch. I might add that he didn't score that inning, however. But I shortly after that, I was injured in a fight in San Francisco outside of a bar after curfew, somewhere I shouldn't have been, doing stuff I shouldn't have been doing. And I separated my shoulder and never played in another major league game. So I'm a one-game phenom.
What effect does it have on you when your career ends because of an injury and you feel like you got that injury doing things that you shouldn't have been doing at a place that you shouldn't have been?
Well, I'm not a fatalist necessarily, but when I look at it now from the perch of 25 years later, I think that if it hadn't have been for that injury, I wouldn't have gone on to become a high school teacher. I would have never become a writer, and I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now, which is writing, which is something much more fulfilling to me personally than playing baseball, although I'm not demeaning or I'm proud of the fact that I was a professional athlete. But I wouldn't have, my life wouldn't have taken the direction that it did because I would have gone on and kept playing baseball. I assume I would have and played several 15 years or 10 years or whatever it is and probably ended up like a Sam Malone, you know, tending bar somewhere and living that life and telling everybody about the time that I did strike out Pete Rose. And so things have a way of working out, and I like to think of it as it was a positive thing that happened, not the way it happened. And sure, I would have liked to have my career have turned out differently, but that's not the way it was. And at the time, I didn't realize that I would never play in the big leagues again because I was consumed with rehabilitating myself and making it back to the big league. So that was my focus at that time, rather than sitting back saying, oh, poor me, I got injured and I'm not in the big leagues anymore.
Since your book is in part about how people are changed by the times, I find it very interesting that you became a father at a time when, on the whole, fathers played a much smaller role. And I mean, if we could generalize about this, fathers played less of a role in the upbringing of their children than many of them do now. Yet you ended up with both of your daughters from two different marriages living with you. They had each asked to live with you, so you became a pretty full time dad there.
I think of anything that I'm proudest of, whether it be the success I've had as a writer or my brief, you know, the fact that I did get in one major league game, or it's my efforts as a parent that have been what I will look back at and be most proud of. And it just came at a time when I got divorced. The mothers got custody of the children because that's the way it was in those days. And certainly they probably, when we're married, had more responsibility for parenting than I did, because I think it's fair that you generalize that that fathers were more distant in those days. But I always wanted custody of my children, and I was fortunate enough to get it later on, and took it very seriously and struggled with it being a single parent. And but I've worked at it very hard, and hopefully, my kids say I did a good job, so I guess that's my ultimate compliment.
My guest is Larry Colton. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Larry Colton. His new book, Goat Brothers, is about how his life and the lives of four of his fraternity brothers changed since the 1960s. I'll tell you what I'm interested in hearing now is how you went from being somebody who, from all appearances anyways, was not very introverted. You were in the jock fraternity. It wasn't about going to classes for you. And then after that, you were an athlete and wasn't given, I think, to a lot of introspection or reading, or certainly not writing. And now you've developed into a writer, and it's your job to sit and think, to reflect on things, your life, other people's lives. You write about sports also. But it's just a different way of seeing the world and a different way of living within it, I think.
Well, I didn't. You know, I had no formal training in writing. I didn't major in journalism. In effect, when I went to college, I majored in becoming an athlete. There was one review who said that I was a discredit to the University of California and an embarrassment to any serious student who went there. But I was as serious as anybody there, except I was focused on being an athlete. I still graduated from there. In fact, the irony of that is my book is now used in a sociology class there at the University of California, a class, incidentally, that I flunked when I was was there. it was a slow process. I didn't set out to be a writer when I was playing professional baseball. The thought of being a writer had never entered my mind. I didn't take notes as I went along. I think I spent 5 years as a high school English teacher, and I think during that period I started writing and started thinking about stuff, and because of the women that I was involved with, and I just started thinking about more. I guess it was because I was being called on the carpet for my behavior so much, I started thinking, well, I guess they got a point here. So, and I became introspective to the point now where it's almost because I've written this book that is so, I tried to be so honest about my life, about other lives of typical males, that I've almost looked forward to the point where I can get brainless again. Now, I don't mean go back to the womanizing ways, but to not have to analyze everything that I've ever done.
Of the four friends that you caught up with to write this book, one of them died in a plane accident. He had a plane and was doing some fancy landing and got killed. What happened to the other three? What are they doing now?
One of them, Lauren Hawley, was a very successful entrepreneur, made a lot of money, and although he failed to file an income tax return and did spend some time in federal prison, but very charismatic guy. His attitudes towards women has changed probably the least of all, and he's just had to undergo surgery for cancer of the throat, and hopefully it's in remission now, and so he's battling cancer right now. Another man, Jim Van Hoften, who was an astronaut and a Top Gun in Vietnam, is now a partner in Bechtel Corporation and is stationed in Hong Kong, has been very successful in business. The third member, Ron Vaughn, is an architect for the state of California.
And Ron Vaughn was the one who hid the fact that he was black in college.
Exactly. And he's, but he's doing well as an architect, and he's had probably the most trouble dealing with the book. But he's just an incredibly compassionate, wonderful human being, and the spirit in which I wrote the book was hopefully will come through to him, and the love that I feel for that man. And I hope nothing but the best. I know he struggled with parts of it, and that has probably been the biggest heartache for me, dealing with that. My own parents don't want to read the book. They're having trouble with it. My mother wants to remember me as you know, the 17-year-old kid that she remembers. My ex-wife, she loved the book. In fact, hosted a party for me. One of the things that I came to grips with during the research of this book were my own addictions, my own compulsive behavior with alcohol and with marijuana. And it was during the process of writing this book and thinking about it and seemingly always doing interviews where alcohol was involved that I quit drinking and using drugs during the research of this book. And that's been over 4 years now.
That's what led you to stop doing interviews in which you and your friends
No, I got busted for drunk driving is what the final blow was, and then I got picked up. And when I was handcuffed and thrown in the back of the squad car, it jerked my shoulder back, and I was in intense pain from the shoulder, the same shoulder that I had injured that ended my baseball career, that... the separated shoulder from my baseball career that happened when I was drunk doing something that I shouldn't have been doing, which was had been 25 years earlier, and it just reinforced the pattern that was involved here. Every time I was getting in trouble, there was either with women or anything else, or with the law, there was usually alcohol involved. And so I would say that was perhaps the epiphany that led me to quit.
Larry Colton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Larry Colton's new book is Goat Brothers.